Thank you. So one issue I'd like to talk about today is seafood and how can we do it more sustainably, and is the offshore going to be our panacea for that? But after, those were really interesting talks, but they were really data dense, so let's just cleanse our mental palate for a bit, and I'm going to ask a very simple question. Is this big? So you can answer yourself, and if I put up a picture like this, you'd say, oh yeah, it's the moon, it's big. But I could say, is this big? And I could have gone the other way, and I could have put up this picture, and you could have said, oh wow, that's actually pretty small. So anytime we're kind of doing these evaluative statements, we need some sort of reference point, and so we know where to begin. So if I ask, is this sustainable? If you've learned anything in the last 10 seconds, you should know we need a reference point. And we need to say, what do we mean sustainable? And what's our reference point? And I can say, well, it depends on the type of protein. Are we talking about, if we're talking about seafood has a lot of benefits to it. It's energy efficient. It's feed efficient. It takes much less feed to get a pound of seafood than it does a pound of terrestrial protein. It's very water efficient. Because of these, you have some ancillary benefits in terms of environmental impacts on the output side. So if we're talking about overall, seafood is good. You know, when you compare, we can grow a pound of shrimp on 1 pound of feed, where it takes about 10 pounds to get a pound of beef. So that's pretty good. But the other thing is, not all seafood is created the same. We have many, many different types of seafood, both in wild fisheries and in aquaculture. These are just some aquaculture species, and as you can see, there's a variety of things up there. There's some finfish, there's some clams, there's even seaweed, which we just heard is a very good thing in nutritionists, and I would completely agree with that. So we're not only talking about just seafood as a class in itself, but then now we have to start getting down into what type of species, and they all have different impacts. And if we're growing animals in aquaculture, we actually need to think about how are we actually growing them. So that takes us to how are they being produced. These are two different shrimp farms. The one on the right is Luan Bay in China. It's extensive production of shrimp for the domestic market in China. So that means they're being fed a low amount of feed, but again, they're really crammed in there. The other one is offshore technology being used to grow shrimp in Mexico. The really interesting thing about this is a small cage. You can see it's about the size of a person. And they actually let the cage biofoul before they put the shrimp in it. And so they're not even feeding the shrimp. They're just growing them on stuff that's settling out of the water. And you're actually taking nutrients out of the water instead of putting them back in. So again, one species, two very different production methods. And I didn't even show intensive production for the export market from China. So you can get many different ways. But all these things, seafood as a whole, what species of seafood, how it's being produced, these are all things we really need to start asking ourselves how is it actually being produced to get down to this question of, is our food being sustainable or not? And so when we look at seafood, 1 billion of the world's poorest people rely on seafood for their main protein. Okay, that's a huge, huge amount of people that rely on seafood. And in terms of us in the developed world, we really rely on it as a nutritious, healthy aspect of our diet. And so because of this, we're seeing the amount of seafood we're going to have to consume increase. These are projections out to 2030. And as you can see, the gold bar is actually what we're catching for the fish meal industry, which has been pretty constant since back to the 1970s. The red is our wild harvest of seafood. And as you can see, it's kind of plateaued. We're not going to be able to catch many more wild fish, even if they're all managed perfectly. And so the blue bars up on top are aquaculture production in the past and what we're expected to get into the future. And if we look at that, we're going to need 40 million metric tons more of aquaculture product to meet our seafood demand by 2030. 40 million metric tons. And that's just to keep up with per capita consumption. That's, you know, in the U.S. we're eating 15 kilograms of seafood per person per year, which actually isn't really that much, but that's a different point. But so just even to keep up with population growth, we're going to need a lot more food. And, you know, and if you start thinking about this, we're going to need a lot more of all food, so not only seafood. So we need to think about how we're going to do this. be able to provide for people and yet not pollute the environment. So in terms of seafood, the U.S. is the third largest consumer of seafood, but we import 85% of our seafood, which means we have a $9 billion seafood deficit. Okay? And this number is even just going to get worse because our population is increasing, our production is not. You know, what are we going to do? And ultimately, if, you know, and just if you guys have never seen this map, this is just a weighted country average by the total amount of aquaculture production. So most of the stuff is being produced in China and Asia, and it's coming over to us. So what does this mean for production in the U.S.? Well, obviously means somehow we're going to have to get out more domestic production. Globally, we're going to have to get out more production everywhere. And, you know, National Geographic, The Economist, New York Times, they've all identified this as a problem that we're going to have to deal with somehow, some way. And, you know, again, there are a lot of benefits of having domestic food production. And actually, I'm not going to go through these in order, minimizing our carbon footprint. This is imports to the U.S. of tilapia. Tilapia went from 10 years ago of not even being on the top 10 consumed seafood to now it's up number 3 or number 4 in our most consumed seafood. Okay, so usually it's actually number 4. So it usually goes salmon, shrimp, tuna, and then tilapia. And so again, we can minimize our carbon. You know, we're not paying to ship food all around. That's good. We can use domestic feed ingredients. You know, the U.S. Soybean Council is really interested in aquaculture. And right now they sell a lot of soy to China, which gets turned into feed, which feeds fish, which then come back here, which seems a little bit skewed. So so we can do that. We can create some jobs. We have typically better environmental regulations than a lot of other countries. So we should be producing domestically. So where are we going to do this? Well, we have three options. We can do it on the coast, but lots of people like to live on the coast, and in general, for some reason, people don't like to look out at any sort of industry. You know, they don't like to look out at aquaculture farms. I don't know why. Having lived on the coast, overlooking aquaculture farms, I kind of enjoyed it, but that's why I'm working where I am. So our coasts are really populated. We really don't have a lot of room to stick aquaculture in the coast. We do have the option to do land-based production of aquaculture. I mean, the New England Aquarium is we're a recirculation facility. We just have a lot of different species, but basically we're doing aquaculture. We're taking animals into captivity and rearing them throughout their life cycle. There's the potential, you know, there's shrimp production in Arizona, there's tilapia production in California, there has been tilapia production in upstate New York. So we can do this in land-based systems. The problem is our land is already crowded. 40% of the U.S. is already tied up in agricultural production, and we're even doing stuff like irrigating the desert to create crops. So we're already doing really weird things on land anyway. And so the question is, you know, could we put aquaculture in there? There is a potential to do some production inside cities, and that's actually a really smart thing to do. You can produce food in your city, and then you're not transporting it. Nobody's ever really put all those pieces together, even though a lot of people are interested in urban aquaculture. But that's not going to hit that 40 million metric tons that the globe needs by 2030. So our last option is offshore. So if you look at the exclusive economic zone, if you take the coast of the U.S. and you draw 200 miles off the coast, that is our sovereign rights. And basically we control that. And if you look at how big the EEZ is, it's 1.5 times the size of the lower 48 states. Okay, so we have a lot of option there. We have a lot of room to put things in. So this is a map of the Gulf of Maine. Welcome, you're at the red arrow, Boston. It's a very large ecosystem. And again, what we've done is we've drawn the 200-mile EEZ limit, and it gets skewed up there by Jordan Basin because Canada's up there and we have to divide it with Canada. So it's been estimated that 40 firms put in 20 square miles of ocean could produce 100,000 metric tons of product a year, seafood, finfish. That little purple spot off by Cash's Ledge, that's 20 square miles. Okay, so to get to the 400 million metric tons, we'd need 400 of those little purple squares. Okay, and if you look at it, you're like, wow, we could put a whole bunch in the Gulf of Maine. Okay, so first thing is, think about that picture I showed you in China. We don't want that to reoccur, so we have to temper our excitement a little bit. The other thing is, this is ocean, and a lot of people think, oh, there's nothing in the ocean, there's nothing going on, but that is actually not the case. We share the ocean with a bunch of other users, and three primary ones are, there's a lot of marine animals in there. In the Gulf of Maine, we have one of the most endangered whales, the North Atlantic right whale. There's only 400 left. It's called the right whale because it was the right whale to hunt. When you killed it, it would float. It had a high oil content. It was slow. They're pretty stupid. So there's only 400 left because of that. There's also a bunch of turtles. There's humpback whales. There's fin whales. We also ship a lot of things in and out of the ports of Boston and Portsmouth and going down into New York. So there's a bunch of ocean traffic. There's a bunch of large vessels moving around. And you can't go putting a whole bunch of small little obstacle courses in the way of big ocean vessels. That just doesn't work. And finally, Tim mentioned earlier in his talk, fishing, lobster fishing in Maine. Most of that occurs in the coast, which is actually not, that's the little 3 mile white section. This is offshore fishing. There's a lot of lobster fishing going on, but there's tuna, there's cod, there's flounder, haddock, a whole bunch of other things. So there's fishing going on. And when you overlap all of these three, you get a map of what's actually going on in the Gulf of Maine. And all of a sudden, it's not this wide open expanse and where we can just throw a farm wherever we want. We actually have to think carefully about where we're going to do that. And if we throw up our little 20 square mile farm in there, we can see it's still in kind of a free zone, but it's not as much of a free zone as it was before we started putting all these other uses on top of it. So the point is, you know, we can start putting aquaculture in the offshore fairly easily, but we are soon going to be bumping up against a whole bunch of other users and creating conflict. And when you get conflict, you get strife, and then more regulation, and that's not a good thing. So my feeling is that aquaculture can be part of an ecological solution for feeding the world, and in part, offshore, we are going to have to think about offshore just because our coasts are really crowded. They're also getting more and more pollution from all of the development that's going on. Our land-based options they're there. There are going to be some significant challenges. One of them is it's a fairly energy-intensive system because you have to continually pump water, and that's not an easy thing to do. So because of that, you know, we are going to have to think about offshore aquaculture development. But there's a lot of other things we can do. We can eat the proper species. Number one, we should be eating more seafood, because what happens if we don't eat seafood? If we go out and if we go have a hamburger, well, that's actually not even a better option at all. Okay? We can eat more vegetables. That's great. In the 70s, we had a big push to be vegetarian, and we never got people quite there. But aquaculture and fisheries do offer a solution of eating more seafood. Eat low on the trophic chain. We should be eating seaweed. That's a great idea. We should be eating mussels. We should be eating clams. These are filter feeders. They're actually removing nutrients from the water. They're lowering our environmental impact from eutrophication. So we should think about that. We should think about, you know, carp is one of the most aquaculture-produced species in the world. It's largely an unfed species. They grow it on plankton blooms and pond, and yet we don't eat it at all in the U.S., which is a shame. And I did write about this a little bit in a paper. If we're talking about farms, we need to make sure that those farms are adhering to some sort of regulation and environmental standard, and there's a bunch of certification programs out there. Global GAP, the Aquaculture Stewardship Council, and the Global Aquaculture Alliance are three of the larger certification programs going on. And so there are ways to make sure that you can get product from better and more responsible farms. You know, and part of this is knowing where your seafood comes from. So whenever you buy seafood, you should ask, where is it from? Is it wild? Is it farmed? If it's farmed, do you know what farm it's from? And you need to start engaging who's ever selling you seafood in these questions. The final thing, which is really coming, it's becoming a really hot topic, is called zonal management. And this is the idea that we need to, it's really good to have certified, well-managed farms, but what happens if you overload an area with farms? That's a bad thing. So what you need to do is you need to have good operating farms, but you can't overload the ecosystem. And so somehow you have to look at the entire zone in which they're being produced. And so again, like I said, this is a new and upcoming idea. Some areas have been a little bit more adaptive at doing this. But then again, this is something that is more of a policy, national level movement. So in 1977, Jacques Cousteau said, "With the Earth's burgeoning populations to feed, we must turn to the sea with a new understanding and new technology. We must learn to farm the sea as we have farmed the land." I agree with this in spirit, but in principle, I think we need to do a better job farming the oceans than we need to do farming the land. I think I was an agriculture major as an undergraduate, and I think we've done some really, really abysmal things. But aquaculture is a relatively young industry. It's, you know, commercial aquaculture has only been around for about 30 years. And we've already made what I would consider to be greater advances than a lot of the terrestrial agriculture production has been. So we need to continue the trajectory we're on, but we need to do it smart. We need to do it wise. We need to do it willingly. And we need to make sure that we are have this end sustainability goal in mind. Oops. And just a real quick advertisement for those of you in Boston tomorrow night, Thursday. Andrew Sharpless, who's the CEO for Oceana, and he just wrote a book called The Perfect Protein, How We Can Save the Oceans and Feed the World. And he will be speaking for free at the New England Aquarium. You can register online at www.neaq.org. Oops. Okay. Thank you. Any questions? First hand up.
So I'm not from Buffalo, New York, but I've worked a lot in Buffalo, New York. There's a really interesting aquaponics program going on with a New Jersey organization called Massachusetts Avenue Project.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been really successful in making people who live next to abundant sources of water, which is really contaminated, particularly with Buffalo, New York.
Yeah.
Buffalo River, Niagara River, Lake Erie, abundant fish, but these have the fish is very contaminated. Making people very aware of farming fish.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and aquaponics, and I'm just curious as to why, in your conversation, I understand the larger picture.
Ooh, excellent.
The larger picture that aquaculture provides more fish, but it seems like you're kind of discounting some of the smaller stuff, and I just want you to talk a little bit more about that.
No, the small stuff is going to be important, and that aquaponics would fall under the urban aquaculture because, you know, the whole idea is, do you want to grow a single species or you can raise two and three species? When I say species, I'm talking about lettuce, tomato, basil over fish. So you actually, from a business standpoint, you get a greater return on your investment. So that's good. There are some challenges with aquaponics, which I think get to be undersold a little bit. Number one, you need plants that can handle low levels of selenium. Hence, you always focus on tomato, basil, and lettuce. And two is that there are going to be energy constraints with urban aquaculture, especially, you know, Buffalo gets really cold in the winter. You have to heat your systems to keep them warm. So, yeah, so again, it's you know, that's urban aquaculture is definitely, and, you know, from the standpoint of creating local, you know, everybody wants to eat within 50 miles, well, then aquaponics, I think, yeah, it's a great idea, and that falls under the urban aquaculture realm. So it will be important. Just if we're really optimizing the way we use, you know, urban environments, I'm not sure how much total protein we can produce that way, but it will be important. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, up here in front.
I'm from Massachusetts, so I'm interested in the wind farms that they're trying to put out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, anytime you put structure in water, fish will aggregate to it, and a lot of times they'll come in to graze on it. The other way wind farms can be an asset for aquaculture is you can actually use them as a mooring platform to put cages off of. One problem they're having trouble with in offshore wind farms and those put in the water is that they're really not sure if they're going to allow boat traffic and traffic within them because they're worried one of the blades is going to fall off and lawsuits and all that. If you go out into the Midwest, you go into the corn and the soybean farms, and every corn and soybean farm has a wind farm in it, and the farmers plow right up to the base of the wind farm. So there's a little bit different attitude of the way agriculture handles wind farms as opposed to the water environment. So again, you know, there's even a plan for a wind farm where the base is hollow and you're actually growing fish inside the base, and that's your cage system, and then you have basically a big wind stanchion above it. So there are, you know, the Europeans have looked into that particular idea. So it can be an asset, but actually there's this whole legal mindset in the water that
the culture of the East Coast looking at a wind farm versus the West Coast and drilling.
Yeah, and that's the wind farms in off the coast of Massachusetts are not a popular idea, and a lot of people, you know, Martha's Vineyard's a very wealthy island. You know, people don't want to pay money to look at wind farms. So, do we have one more? Or we're good? Okay.
Thank you, Michael. That was great.